Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Monday, January 5th. This morning, we expect to have new numbers on the New Year's Eve revelry. We hear from the Honolulu Police Department and get the latest on fireworks violations. Hawaii Business Magazine examines the economic outlook for 2026. More uncertainty ahead. And as we mark the 50th anniversary of Kaho'olawe, we hear from a young filmmaker who placed second in a national contest and received priceless mentorship from filmmaker Ken Burns. We also learn more about an invasive seaweed that has now been found in pristine waters off a National Marine Monument. And it is a head-scratcher. Why are some states enacting laws about training to style curly hair? The demand for curly cuts in Hawaii is growing. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This morning, state law enforcement and Honolulu Police Department are releasing the latest numbers for the New Year's Eve celebration. Assistant Chief Brian Lynch joins us now to talk about the efforts to keep the public safe, reduce the number of people hurt or killed by illegal fireworks, and to avoid scenes like we saw unfold in an Oahu neighborhood just a year ago. Chief Lynch, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Catherine. Hi, how are you? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, and we hope it is a safer New Year for everybody. You know, just, it's been very sobering, you know, when we woke up a year ago, just to realize the extent of that blast in that neighborhood. Do you remember what it was like for you when you realized how bad it was?
Yeah, it was a moment for reflection and thought. Who would have thought that something like that could have happened on our island in a time like New Year's? It was very unfortunate.
Well, you know, we hope that people realize the severity of what we're dealing with. When you play with fireworks, you know, you get burned. So what can you tell us? What's the latest as far as the numbers that you got from the state law enforcement and HPD?
So we have been working with DLE the entire year on other things as well as fireworks. For New Year's in particular, we did several operations. DLE went out with drones. We had teams strategically going through the island doing enforcement. The actual numbers will come out in the press release that we're going to do after this phone call. I can tell you for us as HPD, last year we had 2 citations, and this current year we had 29 citations. So
wow.
Enforcement has stepped up. I think it's worth mentioning that the community really came forward and made a huge difference. I think a lot of people can say that it was a lot quieter this New Year's as compared to prior New Year's. And then the time period that people actually used fireworks was pretty consistent with the time period that the permits were designated for. So kudos to the community for really coming forward and participating and wanting to make a difference for all of us together.
Well, I know in my neighborhood in Kaimuki, you know, there was someone that was setting off illegal aerials, and, you know, I walked out on my lanai, but then I was also encouraged because I saw a drone go up, and I was like, good, somebody's watching.
Yeah, we're really using technology to our advantage. We're still learning the ins and outs, but it's really great. It's an important tool that we can use to make the community safer.
And I imagine as you folks are doing these investigations with DLE, that is probably going to take a while before maybe there are additional arrests once you get the evidence together.
Yes, this is true. As you know, the new laws were enacted July of last year. So that does open doors for us as enforcement. But, you know, the key is everybody working together as an island community to come forward and really make a difference to stop this insane amount of basically bombs going off. You know, it never used to be like this. Over the years, it's gotten worse. So I think we really need to pause, go back to like really how it was years ago when we didn't have these huge bombs that are blowing things up. So I think that's our intent and the direction we're headed in.
Well, you know, at a recent family gathering this weekend, you know, I was checking with people, oh, well, what was it like in your neighborhood in Mililani? What was it like in Wahewa, you know, or on the west side? You know, what was it like for your officers out on patrol?
It was a busy night. Overall, we had 121 arrests island-wide. That wasn't for fireworks, but that was just total of other stuff going on. So, you know, the world doesn't wait for us. Things happen, and we have to respond to everything, not only fireworks. However, we were able to, you know, traverse that mission and be able to do that efficiently. And fortunately, none of the officers got hurt. Everybody made it home, and, you know, there were some injuries to the community that we would, you know, would rather avoid, but it was unfortunate there were some. But we were able to go and document those. Those investigations are pending right now. So, all in all, I think it was a better New Year as compared to last year.
Yes, I know. I understand that there was even you know, some children involved, which is just unfortunate. You know, just. But you just want to try and keep everybody safe, you know. But what about the impaired driving cases that you might have seen over the holiday?
Yeah, the impaired driving statistics will come out in the press release. Typically, we do go out and we have holiday roadblocks to prevent impaired driving. So we do normally good in that area to make arrests, especially during the holiday seasons.
Well, I know we've already had three fatalities, I think, on the road, and, you know, whether or not it had to do with, you know, speed or alcohol or drugs, that's, you know, something that needs to be worked out. But, yeah, the number of fatalities that we saw on our roads statewide was really disheartening for last year.
I would agree with you, and this goes back to a common theme, whether it's, you know, driving habits and or fireworks. You know, us as an island community, we really need to band together to work towards a safer community for all of us, because it's just an island. We all live here together. If we don't make that effort to, you know, respect each other and follow the rules and the laws, we're gonna keep, you know, running into these unfortunate accidents. I mean, why do we have to have these accidents? It really doesn't have to happen that way. If we slow down, if we think about common respect for, you know, our fellow citizens here on the island, that respect will lead us in a better direction versus all of the stuff that's happening with fireworks and even with traffic fatalities. I mean, it's unfortunate. We really need to make a change.
Well, what else can you tell us about the illegal fireworks enforcement? You know, were there particular areas where you had your patrol units focus on? You know, was it the west side, central Oahu? I mean, you know, what was the landscape that night?
Yeah, so everyone had, you know, their things going on that night. But typically, at least most New Year's, in this New Year's, west side, what we would call the rural areas of the island, have the more incidences of illegal fireworks as compared to town side. So, yeah, west side, rural areas.
Well, I know we were worried about the weather because it had been breezy, but we did have a lot of rain, so hopefully, you know, that kind of cut down the risk for wildfires.
I would agree. And, you know, smoke often is a topic of discussion when it comes to New Year's and fireworks. I want to say, or at least where I live on the windward side, and the smoke wasn't anything like it normally is. So, you know, and the wind wasn't hardly too bad. So I think, again, everybody playing along, respecting the rules, you know, shorten the window for more smoke to be built up in the community. So, I mean, again, kudos to the community for, you know, coming forward and staying within the rules.
Well, you know, I know when you folks did the initial assessment on New Year's Day, I think there was an estimate of like 590-some calls, two arrests. You know, is there anything more you can tell us about, you know, other actions taken around illegals?
There's a lot of good information that's going to come out on the press release within an hour or so after this interview. I would defer to that because we want to come forth as one group, as law enforcement, to report this the statistics.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's where we're at with that.
Well, you know, I know that the department, you know, has been working and trying to do its best, but you folks do have vacancies within HPD. How did that affect, you know, your ability to be, you know, out in the street that night?
So there's no debating. We do have vacancies that we would like to fill. So if you're of that age and you need a job, come look us up, honolulupd.org. But I can tell you, and kudos to the officers that were working that night. They were out in the numbers that we needed to do enforcement. For us as the police department, whatever the mission is, we rise to the occasion. And that's just a credit to our officers that come to work every day and do the job. And when the job calls, they come. And so, you know, we currently meet what we need to do to keep the community safe.
Well, I know that the state lawmakers have given DLE additional money. You know, they've got that task force. They're trying to step up a lab. What else does HPD need to, you know, be effective out on the streets on, you know, nights like this?
Well, nights like this, we want to partner again with the DLE and other law enforcement entities. I think working together, we do better for the island and the state. So we're still culminating our relationships with DLE, and we look forward to, you know, fostering those relationships, using technology together, and really making a difference for the community.
All right. Okay. Well, we appreciate your time this morning, Assistant Chief, and we'll look forward to those numbers later today.
Sure. No problem.
All right. Mahalo.
Thank you.
We have been hearing from Assistant Chief Brian Lynch from the Honolulu Police Department about the enforcement actions taken against fireworks scoff laws during New Year's Eve celebrations here on Oahu.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Merriman's Restaurants on Oahu, Maui, Hawaii Island, and Kauai. Details and reservations at merrimanshawaii.com.
I'm Marco Werman. The World's Newsroom brings you the big picture stories and some other stuff.
It may surprise you to learn, but in Italy, many, many mafiosi are religious.
You don't expect to find a swimming pool in the middle of the desert.
The rule number one when planning a golf course in China is to not call it a golf course.
Join us and hear the world.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
The economic outlook for 2026 is the focus of the January issue of Hawaii Business Magazine. Reporter and former editor Cynthia Wesendorf joined us in studio on Friday to talk about what industry leaders are forecasting. Last year was full of uncertainty with tariff threats, and economists are expecting more of the same, but there was some hope and a touch of optimism. Here's Wesendorf.
A third of the economy in Hawaii is based on tourism, and it's based on federal spending. And what I learned is that tourism in the last number of years has shifted. So about 80% of the visitors come from the U.S. mainland. In 2019, that would have been 60%. So there's a heavy concentration of American tourists. And all of those people are subject to any changes in the U.S. economy. We've seen hiring is slowing on the mainland and also in Hawaii. We're seeing that inflation is rising, both in Hawaii and on the mainland. And also, there's unemployment is rising. So these, and also spending, like there seems to be a lot of consumer spending, but it's mostly from the top 10% of earners in America. So this is like, you know, rich people are spending, everybody else is holding back.
The last tourism numbers that I looked at, we had fewer visitors. They were staying a little bit longer and spending a little bit more, you know, so that was hopeful. And I know we ended strong with the marathon numbers in record territory. And that also was being driven by, I think, the marketing in California. But yeah, what are they saying about the return of our Japanese visitors?
That's a bright spot, I think. There's a little movement with Japanese visitors, so they do seem to be coming back. This is what I've heard. I also talked to people at the Hawaii representative of Hawaiian Alaska Airlines, and he said they're seeing more Japanese people are booking flights to Hawaii, that this is like a rising number. It's nothing like 2019, but it is on the good trajectory for them, so they're very happy about that.
Okay, slow and steady.
Slow and steady, but and also I think there's more visitors coming to Maui, so that's always been a weak spot. But I think like Carl Bonham at the UA Economic Research Organization, he's very worried about the fact that Hawaii is so reliant on American visitors at this point, and it's not diversified.
And you had also mentioned the federal spending that our economy relies on. We know that the military is doing lots of construction. What else are you hearing out there?
Yeah, it is like a mixed bag, right? So I think for the military, there's a lot of money coming in. In 2025, there was an announcement of a giant, like $8 billion contract to make infrastructure improvements to military bases. I think it's mostly the Pearl Harbor base. And a lot of local companies were included in that contract so they can bid on it. This is $8 billion that will extend until 2033. So this is a giant piece of federal funding that's coming into Hawaii. So that's like good, but I think everything that's related to the safety net, to healthcare, that's like SNAP funding, that's education, that's even FEMA and disaster recovery, all of that is on the chopping block. And this is going to hurt Hawaii a lot. It's going to be very painful.
We saw the contraction that the University of Hawaii has had to make just because so many of their funds, research funds, got paused or ended. And so that's going to be a whole another like regrouping of, okay, you know, what's left.
That's right. That's right. There's already been like a lot of in the sciences and health research is being cut. But I think it's just rolling out. There's fears that there can be just giant cuts. You could have cuts to special ed in the public schools, right? We're also seeing cuts to subsidies for the plans on the Affordable Care Act, health plans that people buy, which is less in Hawaii than other states because Hawaii has a pretty robust health insurance coverage. We have one of the best in Hawaii, but that is being kind of shaken and it can really topple in the next few years as the federal government cuts back on Medicaid and Obamacare subsidies.
I just was talking to a federal worker and they were worried about another continuing resolution. Are we going to be working without paychecks, is what this worker told me again after just getting a sigh of relief that the government got funded again. But yeah, so much uncertainty. Anything else that our listeners can look to in this edition?
I think a lot of it is you can read pieces here and there through the year, so just try to gather it up. But I do think that construction, just generally, in addition to the military construction, there's just a lot of projects going on. There's a lot of housing, multifamily housing. Kaka'ako is like cranes everywhere. There's warehouses being built out in West Oahu, like lots and lots. There's also infrastructure projects. We have the rail is continuing. We have the Aloha Stadium rebuild, right? That's going to be starting up in 2026 and through the years. So I think that's like a big bright spot. But I did talk to the president of Nordic PCL, and he said that, you know, they're really excited about all this money that's coming in for construction, but they do have workforce shortages. There's labor shortages. He says he hasn't seen ICE raids on any of their sites yet. They struggle to find enough workers to build. And there's also the issue of the rising cost of material. We said shipping prices can go up. There's like middlemen that are like part of the jacking prices up. the material costs are up and there's tariffs, right? So these tariffs are just, a lot of their stuff comes from Asia.
Yeah, so we'll just have a little more uncertainty for the rest of 2026.
Exactly.
That was Cynthia Wesendorf with Hawaii Business Magazine. You can find her cover story in this month's issue of Hawaii Business Magazine or read it online at hawaiibusiness.com. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. We're diving into a stretch of notable surf breaks this morning. The world-renowned 7-mile miracle refers to a sandy stretch from Haleiwa to Sunset Beach on Oahu's North Shore. During the winter season, it's common for storms to begin off the coast of Japan and to send swells across the Pacific Basin directly to the North Shore. Some of the surf breaks, like Waimea Bay, arise from a perfect storm of natural conditions. The swells arrive with long wavelengths and hit an ocean floor abruptly, causing waves to crest and break at a height of 10 meters or more. In comparison, places like Florida and California have a large continental shelf that extends gradually and absorbs most of a wave's energy before it reaches the shore. For today's quiz, can you tell us how many surf breaks can be found along the 7-mile miracle? Just give her the number. Give us the number. You don't have to name all of them. Call us at 808-941-3689 or toll free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for formerly homeless families, individuals, and kupuna, such as the Institute for Human Services, NereidHawaii.com.
A gathering took place in Wailuku yesterday to mark the 50th anniversary of the landing by the Kaho'olawe Nine. Members of the Protect Kaho'olawe Ohana proclaimed that 2026 will be a year of Aloha Aina reactivation. On Oahu, Walter Riddy, a member of the Kaho'olawe Nine, held an event to protest the military's ongoing land use. Speakers included former Governor John Wahe'e and Professor John Osorio. The event also included a screening of a film by Kalamaku Crab. The short documentary made by the Kamehameha School student recently placed second in a national history competition. Here's a clip from her film.
Among the 8 major Hawaiian islands in the Pacific Ocean lies Kaho'olawe. In 1941, the U.S. Navy began using Kaho'olawe for target practice. Just 35 years later, a group of Hawaiians believed it was their responsibility to protest the U.S. Navy's actions on Kaho'olawe, arguing that the bombing interfered with their cultural right to exercise religion, historical site preservation, and the island's environmental protection. Kohe Malamalama Okanaloa is another name for Kaho'olawe, translating to the southern beacon of Kanaloa, the Hawaiian god of the ocean, voyaging, and healing. Similar to its ancient name, Kaho'olawe was initially used as a navigational center for voyaging by Hawaiians. In the late 1700s, the Hawaiian monarchy established Kaho'olawe as a ranching land and later a penal colony. In 1893, the illegal annexation of the Hawaiian kingdom took place. These conditions further diminished the island's spiritual reverence and cultural significance. So, when the U.S. entered World War II, the United States identified Kohoʻolawe as a strategic training ground for target practice. The island continued to be used for militarism into the Cold War as the U.S. sought lands to practice detonation of new weapons. The most renowned explosion was Sailor Hat that detonated at Puhiananui, the southwestern tip of Kohoʻolawe in 1965. Operation Sailor Hat used three separate 500-ton TNT bombs in order to test the survivability of U.S. naval ships against simulated nuclear explosions. These detonations left irrevocable damage to Kohoʻolawe. The bombs hit the island's water table, leaving the groundwater to be lost at sea with its inability to be replenished or recovered.
We spoke with Crab recently about her film featuring the Protect Kohoʻolawe Ohana's fight. It was part of the History Day project, and her production was just one of six that won a National Next Generation Angels Award. It's an award that came with a mentoring session with noted documentary filmmaker Ken Burns. We talked about her interest in the island.
So then, being in high school, I wanted to grow stronger to who I am as a Hawaiian and like my spiritual and cultural identity. So then I decided to look more into the history of Kohoʻolawe, its people, and really knowing more about it, because before doing this project, I really didn't know anything about the island and didn't know why they felt such a strong connection. So that's what really got me into it, was wanting to connect to my Hawaiian culture further and then understanding how it changed them.
Have you had an opportunity to go there to
see it?
Yes,
yes. So a lot of the video that I used in my documentary was my own video. So I was able to go for the closing of Makahiki season. And I went with many of my classmates who go there like annually. And I went with my dad, my cousin, and then her husband. And it was very surreal. It was one of the first ceremonies I was actually able to participate in, because usually I go with my dad, but I'm usually only there to watch. But then this one, being able to like fully immerse yourself, and then we were able to do kapukai. So being able to do all of those things was a really surreal experience.
I remember when I got to see Kohoʻolawe for the first time, and the military was giving us a tour, mm-hmm. and they were talking about the cleanup, and it would just seem like, wow, this is such a monumental project, you know, but it was a necessary thing mm-hmm. to heal the land and to heal the community. But one thing that I was struck by when I saw your film was just the images, you know, the black and white images of the blast, how mm-hmm. powerful, you know, a single blast could be on the landscape. Mm-hmm. What was that like for you when you saw that image?
I think it was such a daunting, like, feeling seeing those images and videos, because like you understand that the island was bombed, but you never understand to like what extent it was bombed. And then you always hear stories, but actually seeing what it was like and then seeing what it looks like now and how damaging it was very hard on your heart to see.
Yeah, and you know, we have talked to many people who are involved in the restoration, and it's really nice to hear about the progress that they are making.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, when you actually go looking for the you know, archival footage and the pictures, it's powerful stuff, right? They say, you know, pictures worth 1,000 words. And I know, like I said, when I saw that in your film, that's how it was for me. And so what was it like being able to learn from Mr. Ken Burns?
Oh, it was pretty amazing. What was cool was he actually hadn't heard about Kohoʻolawe before my film. So it was nice to hear that he was able to take away something from it. And then obviously getting Manaʻo from someone who's such a renowned figure. I remember in my history class watching documentaries on him. And then that was part of my inspiration to create my own documentary. And then having him actually review and talk about my documentary was very heartfelt. He talked about how emotional it was watching it. And I think that was my goal for people who didn't know about the island, to take away as much as they can from the Hawaiians and environmentalist efforts to reclaim it.
Yes, and you know, he's such a terrific storyteller, mm-hmm. you know, and I watched the Civil War documentary, the latest one on PBS, and yeah, it just really brings that history to life again.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you want to say to other potential budding filmmakers out there about this process and the experience of being able to talk one-on-one with him about your project?
I would say the importance of knowing what you want viewers to take away. I remember what I wanted viewers to take away was the importance of land and culture to Hawaiians and how it shouldn't be overlooked for American militarization and how important it is for Hawaiians to have the right to culture and have the right to land and have the right to continue to practice it in present times.
And, you know, when you were over there on Kaho'olawe, I don't know, do you recall anything else you were struck by, you know, in your visit, knowing, you know, all the research that went into telling its story?
I think what I remember the most about going to Kaho'olawe was recalling the stories that Uncle Walter and Auntie Loretta talked about, and then almost like reliving like their lives and their time on Kaho'olawe, like trying to reimagine what it was like when they first occupied the island in 1976, and then just retracing how he would talk about like going up a hill and then stepping on rocks and stepping on all the kiawe, and then just telling my friends about it and perpetuating their stories.
And do you plan to go back and visit again soon?
Yes, I really want to go again for the closing of Makahiki season this following year.
And gosh, I don't know, anything else you want to share with our listeners about that experience of submitting your film and winning, and then, like I said, being able to get some mentoring from Mr. Burns?
I think one of the takeaways I had was really being able to share about Kaho'olawe on a global scale. There were so many people up there in Maryland at the competition who had never heard about Kaho'olawe but could relate in so many other ways because of ways that they have been affected by militarization or colonization in their respective native groups. So it was just so important to continue sharing these stories in whatever media we choose to do so.
And then what are your plans when you graduate from high school?
Some of my plans is in college, I want to study social justice and advocacy and hopefully minor in filmmaking.
We've been hearing from Kamehameha School student Kalamaku Crab. Her film about Kaho'olawe won second place in a National History Day competition. Winners got a mentoring session with acclaimed filmmaker Ken Burns. Crab is well on her way as a storyteller.
Aloha, I'm Jess Woodward, a graduate student and veteran from Makakilo. I'm a thankful monthly supporter of Hawaii Public Radio. One of my favorite parts about Hawaii Public Radio is how much it affects the community in a positive way. I really feel strongly about supporting this radio station so that it can continue to provide that community for everyone.
Become a member today at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor The Hidden Nene.
Once an invasive species takes hold, it is tough to eradicate, and that's the case for a type of seaweed in our waters that has recently spread to the Papahanao Makuakea National Marine Sanctuary. Here to tell us more is HPR's Mark Liddell. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine, and that's correct. There is a seaweed commonly known as the prickly seaweed. Its scientific name is Acanthophora spicifera. I hope I pronounced that right. Yeah, it was just found in Midway. It's about 1,200 miles away from the main Hawaiian islands, and it is the most abundant of about 20 or so invasive species in the state. There's not really a plan to eradicate it at this point because it's so widespread. And the story I ran last week, but it's about a recent scientific article about some researchers who were at Midway who are doing research on a different type of seaweed. And I believe it was in 2022, but they discovered it for the first time while doing that research. And then they published it, the paper, I think maybe a couple of months ago. One of the researchers who was out there, her name is Taylor Williams, who is a Dr. Nancy Foster scholar with NOAA's Office of National Marine Sanctuaries. She was one of the researchers there again. We met up at Ala Moana Beach because there's a bunch of the seaweed there. We talked about that, and she had some of this prickly seaweed in her hand because it was so easy to find at Ala Moana.
You could tell it's Acanthophora because it has these cylindrical branching patterns with some spinous branching along the main axis. And if you touch it in the water, you can tell it's really crunchy. And when you feel it, it's very prickly, which is how it gets its common name, prickly seaweed. And if you look closely, it sort of has many different colors. It is consumed by some herbivores. So sea turtles eat it, some herbivorous fish will eat it. In 2022, we found it at Midway, although it could have been there long before 2022. That's just when it was brought to our attention. And yeah, it was first introduced in the 1950s from a barge coming from Guam. And it was first found in Pearl Harbor, and then very quickly, within about 10 years, had spread to all of the main 8 Hawaiian islands.
And so when it got here, one of the reasons why it was able to spread so quickly was because it can thrive really well, as many invasive species do, in like a wide variety of habitats. And it can reproduce both sexually and asexually. So it can just fragment off into little pieces, and then those
terrible
pieces. Yeah. And so that's why it was able to spread in just 10 years to all of the 8 main Hawaiian islands. Just was able to outcompete all of the native species there. The article that was that just kind of revealed that the prickly seaweed was found at Midway, the leading idea is that it was biofouling, or so when microorganisms attach to sort of the hulls of ships, and then the ships kind of take those species to different places. And again, biofouling, man-made vessels, that's a common way for invasive species to spread. And even though there's still research going on it, it wouldn't be surprised if that's how it got to Midway. I talked about that a little bit more with NOAA Resource Protection Specialist Brian Hawk.
And then Midway is kind of the hot spot for alien species. Of the about 65 species that are up there, most of them are present at Midway. And that's most likely due to the previous presence as a military base for Battle of Midway and all those type of things. There was a lot going on around World War II where biosecurity was not at the top of people's minds, you know. So that's why it's kind of the hot spot up in this kind of pristine, remote place.
And, you know, once it reached Midway, there was a bunch of stuff that took place. The federal government, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, they started doing these biosecurity measures, making sure that there wasn't any more of the species on boats and other vessels kind of traveling in.
Oh, yeah. I'm just thinking all the research vessels, or even the vessels that go to collect marine debris.
Yeah.
Right?
And, you know, that there are already rules on that, but, you know, they just kind of tightened them up to make sure that didn't happen. Also, you know, scientists are trying to learn more about how the prickly seaweed reproduces, also in an effort to, you know, stop it from spreading. There was a recent research study kind of along the same timeline as the discovery of it that showed that there is this I wouldn't call it novel, but there's this effective sampling method where you can just collect ocean water and then use that to detect whether or not the species is in the water by just detecting its DNA. Because a lot of times, to detect the species, the invasive species in these areas, you kind of have to look for them visually, which is there's a huge range, or false positives
right.
Are really common. And I talked with researcher Patrick Nichols, who co-authored that study.
It works extremely well. It works in a lot of cases. It's more sensitive than if you were visually going to look for it, because in a lot of these areas, it can be very cropped and tiny. So if you're not exactly sure what you're looking for, again, all of these organisms are producing their DNA into the water, so we can just isolate that instead, kind of like, you know, crime scene investigators. It is an ideal test in order to map out the distribution of things, especially these like macroalgae that can be visually difficult to distinguish from one another, especially for people who don't have algal identification skills. Like pretty much anybody could collect an environmental sample of water and then we could process it for the DNA.
And so that is super helpful because, you know, you're in this remote area, and I didn't realize also that the primary way that folks try to identify these species is just by looking for them while they're snorkeling or diving, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, that's a lot of territory
to
cover.
Right, especially out in, you know, Papahanao, Mokuakea. You know, I guess maybe the last point I'll make about this story is that when I was talking to a lot of the folks about this, there was this emphasis on those biosecurity protections or protocols when going, especially into the monument slash it's now a sanctuary. And folks are hoping that, you know, that those stay in place and maybe get stronger. And like we'd mentioned earlier, that they are in place, but there are exceptions to it. So some cargo ships and military vessels, they are exempt for that.
Mm-hmm.
So that allows
them to carry it as well.
Yeah. Hopefully that isn't the case.
Right.
But I guess we'll see.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much, Mark.
Thanks.
We've been talking to HPR's Mark Ladau. You can read this story and others on our website, HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Osher Lifelong Learning Institute for ages 50 and older, with courses from art and film to history and gardening. Classes begin February 2nd, olliuhm.org.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Jacob Soboroff joins us to talk about his new book, Firestorm, The Great Los Angeles Fires and America's New Age of Disaster. He covered the fires as a reporter while watching his childhood neighborhood, the Pacific Palisades, burn, bringing a deeply personal lens to a national crisis. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Support for HPR comes from Blue Note Hawaii, presenting indie folk artist M. Ward. His solo show features his analog blend of Americana, blues, and lo-fi music this Thursday. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
Now it's time to reveal the answer to today's quiz. Earlier, we told you about the so-called 7 Mile Miracle. It's a stretch along Oahu's North Shore, known for epic surf breaks, including pinballs, log cabins, and pipeline. Because the Hawaiian Islands don't sit on a continental shelf, surf breaks crest over reefs and plunge to shore without losing much energy. Some have compared the breaks on the North Shore to a ramp built for motorcycle stunts. A perfect balance between wave height and length. Big wave surfing got its start along the 7 Mile stretch that includes Banzai Pipeline, Rocky Point, and Sunset Beach. For our quiz today, we asked you for the number of surf breaks in the world-renowned 7 Mile Miracle. We were looking for 36, but we have no winners. We stumped you on that one. That's our quiz for today. If you have one, you can send it to TalkBack at HawaiiPublicRadio.org. Did Did you know that 6 states across the country mandate hairdressers to learn how to style curly hair? It may not be something on your radar, but it is on HPR's Cassie Ordonez's mind. She has curly hair. Welcome.
What an intro. Thanks for having me.
It is crazy. I mean, it's just amazing to me that states have to require this.
Yeah, but that comes after a demand from hair salon stylists and constituents who've heard so many horror stories about having botched hair. And it's more than just, you know, having the perfect hairstyle. It's also the safety of the clients, making sure that, you know, they have the right hair products. They also need like the right hairstyle, but also to make sure they're not being injured by any scissors or shears as well. But there is a high demand for curly haircuts, especially here in Hawaii. But not many hairdressers in Hawaii can do the job. And that's because Hawaii doesn't require it by law to teach students on how to cut textured hair.
So who are the states that require it?
It's actually Louisiana, California, Maine, Minnesota, Washington, and Connecticut. They make it a requirement. And Louisiana was actually the first state in the U.S. to mandate it by law. And that was in 2021, so fairly recently. But, you know, curly hair, it is trending again. People are wearing their hair more natural, or straight hair folks are getting a perm to achieve that look. We actually see that more from like the K-pop fandom, just so they can achieve that curly hair look. I did spend time with a Native Hawaiian hairstylist here in Honolulu last month. He had just worked with a client who wanted a perm, which is a chemical treatment that turns straight hair into curly hair. And then after, he worked with a Native Hawaiian client who has very thick, voluminous, curly hair. So there's a diversity of work that hairstylists need to learn. But Jason Victorino said he's only one of about 5 hairstylists at Salon 808 who specialize in cutting and styling textured hair. And he and those stylists, they only make up about 16% of the total staff there at Salon 808. That's about 30 total in staff. But he said there's a huge difference in cutting curly hair compared to straight hair.
Is a huge difference. I mean, first of all, like if you just have like straighter hair, it's going to be a bit more, I would say more, a little bit more oilier, you know, whereas curly hair needs a bit more moisture. You can't just go ahead and cut it. We want to see how your hair actually falls first. You know, you don't want to just go in there and cut it up and hope that it's going to be doing its best. But it really depends on the person and their basic needs. Like if they're going to wear their hair just natural every day, you know, then I'm not necessarily going to go and smooth them out and then cut the hair. But my client Justice, for example, because sometimes I will smooth her hair, most times actually I'll smooth her hair because I want to see where her hair is lying and where it's breaking and stuff. And most people that have curly hair, they're just putting it up and they're not even wearing it natural. So I want to take care of all that little breakage pieces. You can't just go in there and cut hair straight, you know, straight across for curly hair. You're going to cause ledges, you're going to cause the hair to build on itself.
But the issue is that Hawaii lacks hairstylists who can also teach the craft. Honolulu Community College is the only accredited public school in Hawaii to teach haircutting and styling. But some of the issue is trying to get the students to feel confident that they can cut curly hair. Here is Kevin Murata. He is the HCC assistant professor.
I do feel like because of the trends that we need to make sure that we're keeping up with it and that we're also expressing that to our students that, hey, trends right now could be this, but maybe when you get out in a year or two, curly hair might disappear, you know? So you have to be able to be flexible. You have to be able to acclimate to the different trends, but you also have to be open to, you know, post-school education, you know what I mean? Continuing education. And so I feel like that is one thing that we are lacking in Hawaii is continuing education. So that's something that, you know, our school is trying to work on right now, and not just to keep up with the trends, but also to make sure that there might be things out there that stylists have been, you know, that have been cutting hair for 20 years might be like, hey, I need a refresher, you know, and they can't really come back to school, but where can I get continuing education at?
Never thought about that.
So at Honolulu Community College, Kevin did say that they updated their curriculum to require cutting textured hair. It's a section, not much of a whole book on it, but he said that the students need to be able to be more versatile in cutting hair because, one, you never know which client you're going to get. But some of the issue that they're facing is that when they bring in clients randomly to their hair school, you don't know what you're going to get. You might get someone just more straight hair. So he's trying to encourage more students to bring in like folks with textured hair to come and practice. But states like Louisiana, I mean, they have a very robust curriculum. I spoke with Erin Marceau, who's the executive director at the Louisiana State Board of Cosmetology, and she says the board has created a task force to help with the revision of their practical exams.
Our practical assessment currently, it's going under another revision. Right now, they have to do a full head of finger waves, which shows dexterity and strength and that you can control the hair. And then also there's a comb out, which is very traditional. So it's going to show you that somebody can do pin curls and dried pin curls, style those out, all of that kind of stuff. And then we have a wet work, which incorporates roller placement, skip waves, more finger waves, there were motion in the back, more pin curls, a brush wave. It's got different sections of it. And then there's a chemical head that also has foil work and perm rods and relaxer and virgin lightener and color retouch. So then there also is the haircut, which is a 90 degree haircut all over the head. So uniform layers. So anywhere that you pick up the hair off the head, it should all be the same distance from the scalp.
And so what did you learn about the cosmetology board that supposed to kind of oversee all this stuff, right?
So I've learned that they still don't require it, and that's because there hasn't been a push for it to require cutting textured hair. However, although there's not so much of a push to require it, there's still hairstylists that say that there needs to be more diversity in the hair salons to cut textured hair.
Yeah, because I would just think, you know, you need the basic skills, and I'm like, hello, you know, but oh well. But thanks so much. Interesting story.
Thanks for having me.
We've been hearing from HBR's Cassie Ordonu about training for hairstylists in Hawaii. You can find her story at hawaiipublicradio.org. That is it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to hear from the new chief of ocean safety. What to know as the surf picks up. Got some feedback for us? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. You can find the conversation as a podcast on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.